The Mindful Medic podcast is proudly sponsored by the Medical Benevolent Association of New South Wales. The MBA of New South Wales is an independent charity that has been supporting doctors in New South Wales and ACT since 1896. They provide specialised counselling, information, referral and financial assistance to doctors and their families during times of adversity or hardship. Their aim is to provide non-judgmental support so that the doctor or family member recovers their well-being and independence and, wherever possible, returns to their vocation. Their services are free, specialised and no referral is necessary. All contact is kept strictly confidential and they are independent of any regulatory body.
In a nutshell, the people, when they become known as wise leaders, are moving from a position of telling people to one of asking for other people's opinions, to one of listening to them and giving them voice, using their authority to give others voice. And I've thought about it a lot, that we have the opportunity to influence other people's lives in ways that we don't always recognize. We don't understand quite how much power we've got. We don't understand the influence that we have on other people. And that sometimes we can just take that and try and make a difference in somebody else's world.
Hello and a warm welcome back to the podcast. Welcome if you're joining us for the first time. My name is Cheryl Martin. I'm your host. Back with season three continued after a bit of a hiatus and a few interruptions. There has been quite a few exciting things happening and I hope to share some of them with you in future episodes. But meanwhile today, I'm delighted to be back sharing the work and wisdom of another incredible guest. I think I've said before that what I enjoy most about this process is the opportunity to talk to people that I consider game changers in their respective fields. I think I call today's guest a trailblazer in this conversation. They're people leading and inspiring positive change, and he is no exception. So you've just heard from him, Dr. Chris Turner. Chris is a fellow emergency physician. You've maybe also picked up his dulcet Scottish tones. He's a fellow Scot. Now working at University Hospitals of Coventry and Warwickshire in England. Importantly, he is also the co-founder of Civility Saves Lives. This is a grassroots organisation dedicated to raising awareness of the impact behaviour has on individuals, teams and organisations. So a theme, you know, related and relevant to previous conversations we've had on this podcast. He tells me he's been taken aback by the appetite for this message, and he's spoken around the world about it, including giving two TED Talks, and he has spoken at the Houses of Parliament. And I'm very grateful that he made some time to speak with us today. I first found out about Chris and his work when a colleague shared his TED Talk with me a few years ago on the impact rudeness has on team performance. It's a really powerful talk. I will link it in the show notes. It led me to learn more about the work that he's doing at Civility Saves Lives. More recently, I've been listening to his own podcast that he co-founded with the Learning from Excellence team, Being Better Together. And again, I will link it in the show notes. It's a fantastic podcast. They've had some really incredible guests. I said to Chris just before we started recording that I've particularly enjoyed when he's gone slightly off-piste in the conversation and gone down a bit of a tangent and invariably shared a lot of gold. And I wanted to pick up on some of those stories and themes today in our conversation. That said, I completely ran over time. I really feel I could have spent a couple of days picking his brains and expertise. There's a lot of gold shared in the conversation that follows. You'll recognise similar themes of leadership, you know, what a culture of safety is in healthcare. He shares his own story and journey as a clinical leader and, you know, talks about the science of civility and the impact of rudeness on team performance. So without further ado, let's get into it. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Dr. Chris Turner, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for making time to speak to me, particularly on a public holiday, and not a holiday Monday, a holiday Thursday. I really appreciate it. I've been very much looking forward to meeting you and to be able to have this conversation. Thank you.
I've been following you, as I've just said, for a couple of years now. It was one of my colleagues that sent me your very powerful TED Talk that you recorded in 2019 about the impact of rudeness on teams and individuals in healthcare. And I think it universally struck a chord with myself and all of my colleagues. And it sent me down a rabbit hole, as it usually does. And, you know, we have a Lex platform in my organisation, which is great, thanks to my colleague Ray. And then I found, I'm a podcast enthusiast, and I found the podcast that you've started as a collaboration with Dr. Adrian Plunkett, Dr. Emma Plunkett, on Being Better Together. I think if any listeners haven't found the podcast, I'm going to link it because it's superb. You've had incredible guests on. I think it's a great way to share ideas. Because I really want to pick your brains and expertise. And just by way of introduction, I know you're an emergency physician. I know you're a fellow Scot, but I also know that you wear a number of hats and that you've had a role as a quality and safety lead for at least a decade. And personally, I think emergency medicine training and practice, places us very well to have a clinical voice in this space. But, I wonder how that came about. Was it default, deliberate? I'd love to hear the story.
Okay. All right. So, just a tiny bit about me. I'm a wee fat, middle-aged, beardy Scotsman who's been dislocated to England for the last 15 years. And I do sometimes feel slightly dislocated. I absolutely love the people I work with. I love an awful lot of living and working around Birmingham in the West Midlands. I love the melting pot bit of it, but I suppose I'm still quite Scottish at heart, and I have to be sometimes careful about how my language goes around that, actually, because we use language a wee bit differently in Scotland. I came to England and got on the West Midlands training rotation in emergency medicine. And at the end of that, so this is me telling you how I got into the quality and safety stuff. At the end of that, my final job was in a place called Midstaffs. This was as a trainee, my final job. So I was about to become a consultant. And Midstaffs was very interesting. If anybody wants to look it up, if you look up Midstaffs Inquiry or Midstaffs Disaster, you will see the tale of an organization which put finance above everything else in terms of its goals and how the organization unraveled. And what ended up happening was that patients suffered, staff suffered, and eventually the organization itself was dissolved. The actual building still exists, but not in that form.
I remember.
And I was there. Yeah, I was there through that whole period of time. And that meant I was there when there was beginning to be some interest in what was going on in the place. And I was there when the first report was done. And I was there when there's a couple of things called the Francis inquiries were done. I was there for the beginning of the first one, but not the second one. And in that period of time, I worked in an organization that absolutely had lost its way. There is no doubt that Midstaffs had lost its way. But then it started to try to find its way. And I got made a consultant in that organization at the same time as we went through this. And one of the most powerful places where you can get learning is in the things that have gone wrong. And I became a consultant in the emergency department. I was actually the clinical lead in the emergency department, but I also took on the lead governance role. And that allowed me an insight into the things that were happening in ways we wouldn't want them to, the things that led to poor outcomes for patients. And they're not necessarily both the same thing, because the space is much messier than that. And in Midstaffs, and Midstaffs is derided as an organization. But in Midstaffs, we went from having a governance system, which was all about pushing back, all about saying why we were right and everybody else was wrong. And I think lots of people who have anything to do with governance will recognize that. Somebody complains about your organization, somebody complains about your department, and you trying to prove to them why you're right and they're wrong, rather than listening to understand, and rather than listening to do right, we listen to be right, so we can get into this combative situation with the people who are complaining about us. And we moved in Midstaffs, we moved from that to something that was much more healthy, where we could listen to people when they came in, where we actually, we made changes based on the experience of patients and the experience of relatives. And we put that front and center. And what I didn't recognize when I was getting into this, and it was led from the top in the organization, what I didn't recognize when I was getting into this was that this was not how other people did it. And eventually in Midstaffs, I burnt out, had a breakdown, stopped eating, stopped sleeping, lost 2.5 stones in 9 weeks. Interestingly, had very, very little insight into this. Yeah. I thought I was okay. And I've seen this in so many other people over the years. I thought I was okay. And eventually recognized I wasn't. And I think there were so many people in that situation in the organization, it was hard for the organization to see that I was there, because I think I was actually just occupying a space that loads of us were in. So there wasn't really any support available from the organization, and I left. I did what lots of people do in that situation. Some people get help, some people just leave. I left. Yeah, yeah. So it is, you know, it's quite an empowering position to be in, to be able, because it's worth remembering that having the ability to leave is a privilege of its own. There are many people who are stuck in jobs that they do not have the ability to leave. So, you know, I'm not looking for the violins here.
Leaving is very stressful, though. I still recall the feelings I had the first time I voted with my feet.
Yeah, well, I suspect that leaving wasn't the most stressful for me, because we'd already been on the front page of the BBC News website and across the news cycle for days at a time. And actually leaving felt like a relief. So I left and I went to another organisation. And there's a beautiful story about how I ended up in the other organisation, which we may or may not get to at some point.
I think with that segue, I'd love you to please tell it now.
Okay, well, we've already said that I have this terrible tendency to go off on tangents.
I told you this is where the gold is.
All right, well, it's your job to pull me back to the bit. So the bit we step off here is when I was beginning to explain about leaving and going to another organisation. But in Midstaffs, it became a completely surreal environment. I would come to work and the local MP would be sitting on a chair outside my office, waiting to speak to me in the morning. I had the chief exec of the NHS come to my office, the chief nursing officer. These people would just appear. And it was a crazy world. And we got to the stage where we had so many management consultants and people coming through the door, we kind of stopped checking who they were. And that sounds unbelievable, but really the whole situation was just surreal. Anyway, one day this guy turns up, and I'd already resigned by this point. So this guy turns up and he comes down and says, hello, can I have a look around? And I said, of course, because that's what we said. We were totally open by this point. We were hiding nothing. And pretty much said okay to everybody. Didn't even really check credentials. And I realized a huge amount of risk that may have had sitting with it. And I showed him around and spent a day with him. And he was another emergency medicine physician. And he stayed all day, which was longer than most people stayed. But at the end of it, he said, okay, thanks. So I'm going home now. Will you walk me to my car? And I did. I walked with him. I walked to the car with him. And the car was at the top car park, which is a decent distance away. And as we were walking up, he said to me, I suppose you know why I'm here. And I actually had no idea. I wasn't even thinking about it. I was probably thinking about 100 other things. I said, I'm sorry, I don't. It's been nice to see you and I've enjoyed the day, but I don't know why you're here. He said, okay, well, and he's an older guy. He said, well, I've come here today because I've been watching you for a wee while and I know that you're broken. I don't think you've got a job to go to and I know you've resigned. And I'm slightly taken aback by this conversation. I said, yeah, that's right. He said, okay, I've got a job for you. You come and work for me. You work for me for a year. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to give you a chance to get better. We'll try and put you back together. And then you decide what you want to do at the end of a year. And the guy was at the next hospital, effectively down the road. And I didn't know him, didn't really know him from Adam. And I was completely taken aback. I didn't anticipate that was going to happen. I was completely touched that somebody who didn't know me would come and that he was in a position of authority where he could create a job for somebody for a year. Now, he may have had a job anyway, but he could create a job for that year and that he bothered himself to get in his car to, the actual drive for him was a 100-mile round trip, to come to see me, to talk about this and to care for somebody else because he recognized the pain and distress that was going on in their life.
What else do you think he saw in you?
Well, he's also Scottish. I don't know. Maybe by the diaspora.
He's very passionate about the work and actually very invested.
Well, I mean, I was undoubtedly very invested. I mean, still am. We all are. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd have to ask him. His name's Don McCready. And Don has been an absolutely fantastic friend over the years since then. Because, I mean, that's more than 10 years ago now. And I was always taken aback. And I've thought about it a lot, that we have the opportunity to influence other people's lives in ways that we don't always recognize. We don't understand quite how much power we've got. We don't understand the influence that we have on other people. And that sometimes we can just take that and try and make a difference in somebody else's world. And
do you still keep in touch?
Yeah. I see Don a lot. I mean, I say a lot. I mean, every couple of months we'll have lunch. And chat about stuff. He's retired now. And, you know, we talk about a ton of stuff and it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, his medical career, I don't know how much you're aware of how things are in medicine in Britain at the moment, but I mean, there's a lot of unhappiness in medicine in Britain at the moment. And I think that Don belonged to a generation which were well recompensed for their work and who felt they stood in high standing. And I would say I probably still belong to that to a certain extent. And I do feel that a lot of my junior colleagues don't feel that they're adequately seen. And I don't think that they feel that they are given the organizational respect that they feel that they've earned. And I don't disagree with them about that. And I think that our organization come from a different, they're in a different time.
I want to pick up on a couple of things there. Thank you for that really powerful story of mentorship. Just on that last bit, and I did say to you that this season of the podcast has a particular focus on leadership. And, you know, I've really enjoyed listening to your perspective as a clinical leader and particularly, you know, different musings that you've had. I love the tangents that have had a leadership focus and you know, how you do elevate your clinical voice. And just on that last part there, I was doing a leadership course last week with a couple of colleagues from our organization, and it was a Brené Brown Dare to Lead course. And, you know, I just kept coming back to this. People want to feel seen, met, heard, and safe, which is pretty much what you've just said there. But then I keep also thinking back to you, you know, just as a new consultant being thrown into this, you know, environment that, you know, was highly
stressful and toxic. And you know, it's hard enough as a new consultant, I feel, to get the basics of, you know, the clinical and technical aspects that you have spent 10 years training for. Never mind, you know, all of the other things that, you know, I think we are not necessarily well equipped for. And, you know, I'm interested to hear how equipped you felt for the role that you took on at that time.
Yeah. Was I equipped? Good grief, no. Not even remotely, but I'm not sure who is equipped for, I mean, the sort of thing that I think any leadership role, we tend to struggle to find who we are in that role. And I mean, there's plenty of evidence that says that this is not a smooth transition. There are a whole bunch of behavioral changes. I think the Paul Pith, Dacher Keltner work on what happens when we move into positions of authority and the risks of the privilege of authority, the risks of us going into authority and then being the big I am, and where we move to further in our careers. And it probably varies depending on who you are, how quickly you get there. But the research that I do is into the development of wisdom. And, you know, in a nutshell, the people, when they become known as wise leaders, are moving from a position of telling people to one of asking for other people's opinions, to one of listening to them and giving them voice, using their authority to give others voice. And I think that, well, I think this idea that when you get into positions of leadership, and this is particularly true of medicine, but I see it in my nursing colleagues as well, we get into these positions of leadership and we think that it means that we should know all the answers. That's kind of the story we've been told. And we have an educational system that is all about personal mastery. It is all about, what do I know? How can I prove that I know it? What's inside my head? How can I get out there? And there's very little in our educational system that values team mastery, in part because it's extremely difficult to measure team mastery. We kind of do it in advanced life support courses and trauma courses and stuff like that. We do it a bit, but we don't really know how to measure it. We don't really know how to grade it. And we don't really know what good looks like. So it's much easier to lean into sets of exams that put you in a room with one other person and you need to be able to get the information from them and then give them the answer, rather than working
through that period.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I
didn't have a cognitive, you know, bandwidth to entertain anything else than getting through exams and the next hurdle.
Absolutely. And that's one of the problems for people who are introducing things like saying we should have human factors, we should have leadership at university. So, you know, there isn't a ton of spare time when people are going through university and not trying to cram information into their head. And you can't expect people to do that and nothing else. People do need to have balance within their lives. They need to go out with their friends. They need to socialize. They need to do all this other stuff. And I think that just to go back to that educational system, the educational system it is what it is. It's organically grown to be what it is. It values personal mastery over team mastery. And all the stuff about working in a team tends to be taught through role modeling, through those people that think about it. But also there's a ton of role modeling out there, which is really quite damaging and disruptive. And I certainly, if you'd asked me when I was a very junior doctor, if you'd asked me what I thought a wise doctor was, I'd have told you it was somebody who had knowledge and skills, because they had answers. That was what I was interested in, answers. Now I'm at that end of my career, that is to say the person who's meant to have knowledge and skills, not wise necessarily, I see it very differently. And I recognize that I don't have all the answers. You don't have all the answers. In fact, anybody who thinks they've got all the answers is wrong. And the best answers in complicated and complex situations, that is to say situations where we are dependent upon other people and it's messy, the best answers come about through information sharing. And Edgar Sheen says it's about asking, not telling. And I think that's a really beautiful, pithy way to put it, asking, not telling.
Yeah, lovely. Of course, now I have more and more questions. But, you know, but I'd like to go back to, I suppose, your own evolution, if you like, as the wise leader, and taking you from, you know, that initial experience of finding yourself in a role, you know, quality, safety, clinical governance, leadership space, and as you've said yourself, very much, you know, by necessity, focused on policy, process, procedure, and also, you know, what we can learn from, you know, what went wrong, to this evolution, to a shift really, to back to people, back to the people, and back to our interactions, back to, you know, the new science of civility and why that matters. And also, you know, despite the ever-changing, highly complex laboratory of errors we work in, most of the time things actually go right. You know, what can we learn from that too? And so that, you know, I have a big question. But I'd love to hear how, you know, what that journey has looked like and what it's taken to get to this place. Big question.
I was just thinking that. So yeah, you try to trigger me in as many different directions as possible in the course of a sentence.
No, but I'm fascinated about, you know, how you made
this transition.
I mean, because I think you're trailblazing, that this is actually,
you know, still quite novel to many of us. You know, I sat in a meeting this week with some really forward-thinking colleagues, and, you know, we're going to talk about appreciative inquiry later, but I, you know, we looked at what is possible and what, where we would like to see things go. And, you know, I think kind of realized there's a lot of steps and a lot of things that need to happen before there, and it is baby steps.
Yeah. Okay, so trailblazing is not how I would see myself at all. Sort of stumbling about in the weeds, being a bit curious about things that I come across, and meeting some lovely, lovely people along the way, and discovering that there's folk who have amazing thoughts about safety and about how we treat each other, and discovering that actually it's a community of people who are very giving of their time and prepared to speak to other people who are interested in it. And, you know, you mentioned safety too, and I guess we might come back to it, but, you know, Eric Holnagle came to Edinburgh to meet with a bunch of 7 or 8 of us just to sit around and spend a day talking about safety within healthcare. And that was a day that was organised by a guy called Neil Spensley. He's a clinical director at paediatric intensive care in Glasgow. Yeah, and
I don't know Neil, but I know of Neil through other colleagues. I was glad. Hi.
All right. You've gone a long way for somebody from Glasgow.
To one of the most Scottish parts of Australia, I reckon. But a small world.
Yeah. So, and Christine Porath, you know, Christine Porath writes, I write to Christine Porath, she writes back. Amir Erez, I mean, these guys have done the groundbreaking research, and they write back when I write to them, which I think is just, I think it's incredible. And it's meant that rather than being alone thinking through this stuff, there have been people who have been prepared to share their wisdom on the journey. But the reason I got into it was, and particularly the civility stuff, was that when I started doing governance, it was really all about process. We'd look at something that went wrong, we'd look at the process, and we go, that's where we deviated. So that's the root cause. That's the problem. And that's kind of comforting when you first start doing it, but it very quickly leads to a blame culture. It very quickly becomes about the individual who has done something that they should not have done. And, you know, one of the things that I learned early in the process was that although we have many things we can learn from airlines, the degree of complexity of what is happening in a cockpit does not touch the sides of something where there are maybe 40, 50 people, 60 people in a department all trying to deliver service to another 50 or 60 patients.
There's people sitting in the aisles, one of the wings has fallen off, you know, is
It's exactly
going down.
Yeah. So our environment is extremely different. And what I got to realize is that there's a bunch of people who are involved in horrible incidents who are precisely the sort of people I want to work with. They're good, hardworking, knowledgeable, frequently extremely kind people. And here they are as the person who appears to have gone off piste and done this terrible thing. And the systems heaved this sigh of relief when they identified them, collectively pointed a finger, and in the opposite of I am Spartacus, everybody else stepped backwards and left that person standing in the middle. And I probably didn't realize this as quickly as I should have done, but it was a kind of low, old-fashioned, low-energy light bulb moment as I gradually realized I'm missing something here. And, you know, what I was missing was that it's way more complex than I'm giving this credit for. And eventually that led to this place of, okay, so who are we to each other? How are we behaving to each other? Because almost always people choose to behave in a certain way because of who they are, but also because of their environment and the interactions they're having with other people. And when I was starting to think about this stuff, I had a chat with a guy called Trevor Dale. Now, Trevor's a human factors expert. He has a company called A-Trainability, and he's another one of these people who just gives time. And Trevor and I were having a conversation, and he told me about Christine Porras' work and all her work on what happens when people are exposed to incivility. And I went away and I read it, and I thought, I think this is possibly the missing link. I think this is maybe the thing that's making a difference in terms of performance, because I was aware that on a personal level, if somebody treats me in a disrespectful way, that it consumed my head. And basically, I would get into situations where I was ruminating on this stuff, and it was stopping me thinking about other things. And I was aware that I wasn't performing at my best at that moment in time. What I thought at that time was that that was a personal failing. I thought, maybe I'm too soft to work around here. Maybe I'm not the right sort of person to work around here. What Christine Porras' work, Christine Pearson, Amir Erez, and a bunch of other people, what their work shows is that these are not personal failings. This is part of the human condition. This is what happens to us when exposed to disrespect, and when we expose others to disrespect, or when we are around people who are being exposed to disrespect, that this has a quantifiable and significant impact on our ability to perform. And that, for me, was just a huge piece of information to realize that that my inability to cope with people who are being assholes to me, or I perceive them as being assholes to me, that my inability to cope with that wasn't a personal failing. That was part of being a person. And that actually we could maybe change performance by changing how we treated each other. And I allude to this, you know, there's 30 years of research into nurses, trying to give nurses the power to defend against hostile interactions from doctors and also from senior nurses. And the bottom line to this is you can give people as much training as you like. It doesn't really work. And I think we were looking at the wrong side of the equation. What we did is we looked at the people who were the victims and we tried to empower them. And I thought, what would happen if we started to talk to the supposed perpetrators? And I say supposed carefully because I don't think, in fact, the evidence is really strong that the people who behave in uncivil ways to other folk don't recognize they're being uncivil a lot of the time.
99%+ of the time.
So what would happen if we just started to say behavior really matters? And it was Joe Farmer and I were having coffee and we were talking about this. And Joe and I started Civility Saves Lives together. And we started talking about the evidence. And he said, I think we should maybe talk to folk about it. I think Joe was an F1 at the time. And he's a trainee in psychiatry now. And he said, we should talk to people about this. And he said, and I quite like the idea of branding and marketing. I think you can't expect people to just go with your big, deep idea unless they've got something they can hold on to. So we toyed with a name for this. I mean, how grandiose, the pair of us having a coffee in Starbucks in Costa.
Fantastic. Coffee and conversation, how novel.
Let's talk to people and let's brand our message. I mean, who the hell did we think we were? Anyway, we're sitting there and we had lots of ideas. And we came up with Civility Saves Lives very early, and then we discarded it because we didn't think that people know what civility was. And that's one of the things that we've had given back to us many, many times over the years, people saying, well, folk don't know what this is. It's turned out to be a benefit, not a hindrance a lot of the time. But at the time, we definitely thought, oh, I'm not sure we want to call it that. And then we came up with the, rather than something saves lives, we came up with something negative, lots of negative stuff. And basically, don't be. So, and you can choose any rude bit of your body you like, and you know, and don't be an asshole would be about the most gentle end of the spectrum when we were talking about it. And they're really seductive. It's really brilliant to get into stuff and to say to people, don't be this, don't be that, because actually hidden within it is an accusation. And we liked that idea, but do you know what happened? I was sitting there and we didn't make our minds up. It took us weeks to make our minds up. But I started thinking about Adrian Plunkett. I started thinking about Adrian and Emma, and I started thinking about learning from Exlis. And I started thinking about...
And they'd already started their work at this point?
Yeah, Adrian, they were about a year and a bit in, and I already knew Adrian. So Adrian and I had been introduced by... God, it's such a small world. Adrian and I were introduced by a guy called Mark Valangi, who works at Birmingham Children's Hospital, who was on the same dissection table as me at university in 1986. So Mark knew Adrian, and what Mark said was, Adrian's another fluffy guy like you, Chris, you should probably talk to each other. So we got introduced, and Adrian blew me away. I mean, he is a towering intellect, Adrian. But I was thinking about their positive message, you know, sort of learning from excellence. And I thought we could probably spin this in a positive way. So rather than saying people don't be an asshole and taking the assumption that nobody comes to work to be an asshole, almost nobody. I mean, it's vanishingly small. I'm thinking, do you appeal to people if you say don't be something? Probably not. We appeal to our desire to punish, but we probably don't appeal to the desire for people to get on board. So we went back and we thought about it, and we thought civility saves lives. And in yet another bit of grandiosity, we got a logo. And I have no idea why we thought that we should have a logo, but it somehow got into it. So we had a logo and we had a name. And it's amazing how quickly people think that you must be a thing if you've got a logo and a name. And then we started going out and talking about
momentum.
It. Yeah. And we resonated. We resonated with people.
All over the world.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
So how did the TED Talk, I've had a few guests on the podcast who have done TED Talks. I have to say a TED Talk is on my bucket list. And I'm always, I love TED Talks and I particularly liked yours. I'm curious about, you know, we talked a lot about, again, on this podcast about the power of storytelling. And I know that you've already even referenced that and personal narrative to get people's attention. And I think that's exactly what you've done here. But I'd love to hear about your own personal preparation and how it actually came about.
Okay, so there's a direct link from the conversation with Joe. The conversation with Joe, we started talking about what we'd talk about, and then we decided to just do it our own way. And I am not a natural on-stage speaker. I get extremely anxious about it before I go on stage. No, I know, and people always say this. Yeah, but I'm completely trained. So, what I would say, if anybody's listening to this and say, if you think I could never do this, I mean, I'm the guy who didn't sleep for 2 days before the first time I got on a stage and effectively performed. A wee bit icky, but I used to be sick before I went on stage.
But this is encouraging so many people.
Just eaten up by nerves. And in a kind of feel the fear but do it anyway sort of way, still kind of forced myself onto stage, partly because I thought this was an important message. I see the audience as a group of friends and hopefully a few people who are going to challenge in an intellectually interesting but not actively hostile fashion.
Yeah.
But that has moved. That's changed over the years of doing this for me. And so basically we started doing our own talks our own way. I'm also really interested in how we get people to hear us.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is this thing of, you know, do you just tell people what to do? Or actually, can you get people on board with an idea by behaving differently? And gradually over years, I realized I'd developed a kind of style, which my style is stories. My style is data. My style is trying to appeal to the things that other people value. And I couldn't have described this when I started. But these days, if I'm getting into this, talking about this stuff, and I'll come back to TED Talk in a second or two because I realize I'm derailing myself.
You introduced me to the work of Lauriella Lingard, who, you know, is all about reclaiming stories for science. And I just think, you were clearly already there.
And also, though, speaking the right language to people. And I think sometimes people become so passionate about whatever their thing is, and it's so bloody obvious to them that they go and tell it to other people. But they tell it in a way that matters to them. And it's a wee bit like it's a wee bit like being the English abroad. And, you know, the classic English abroad thing is that, you know, somebody speaks to somebody foreign, they speak louder and slower, with an English accent, not a Scottish one. And of course, all that we're doing is we're speaking our language in a essentially ever more sort of pushing and sometimes hostile way, when what people need is their language. They need to hear something in the language that matters to them or the language they can understand. And just because fundamentally being kind to each other is important to me, it doesn't mean that it's important to other people, that fundamentally civility is important to me, although I'm a man who has a history of uncivil interactions, as we all do. So, you know, please, you know, don't think there's any bit of me that's holier than thou about this. I screw this stuff up, same as everybody else, but I do it in a kind of knowing way. And it probably helps to change my behavior by having some insight into the impact of it. So working out what people's levers are, what's going to matter to the person I'm talking to. And if I'm talking to a broad audience, like in the TED Talk stuff, then it's stories, it's data. I'll try and chuck some money in there if I can manage. But if I'm going to go and talk to frontline clinicians, my conversation with them tends to be about excellence. It tends to be about creating teams that might achieve that collectively. And it tends to be about personal and team mastery. And sometimes we talk about education because that matters to loads of frontline people. If I'm talking to executive boards, I don't really talk about that. I talk to them about, I mention excellence because they want to be working in world-class organizations. I mention excellence, but I talk about finance. I talk about the evidence base for what happens if you're in a healthcare organization at the top end of the civility scale. And there's 2011 work by Crewe on this, Crewe Veterans Affairs guys in America. And if you were at the top end of the civility scale versus the bottom end of the civility scale for an organization, you saved $26.2 million a year on sickness absence. And now that's a language that most boards can get behind. It's not the language of it's nice to be nice. This is the language of holy crap, we can save ourselves lots of money. Also, if you're at the top end of the civility scale, you have increased staff satisfaction, increased staff engagement. Increased staff engagement is the number one predictive factor for KPIs in organizations. And if I'm talking to execs, that's what I talk about. I talk about their reputation. And I talk about you can improve your organizational reputation. And that means their reputation as individuals. If it's possible to move your organization to this point in the scale. And what it's meant is that the arguments that I make are now far more tailored for the people that I'm talking to. And when I'm doing one-on-one work, and I do a fair bit of one-on-one work, the first bit of that is always about what matters to the person that I'm talking to. Because, you know, what matters to me isn't important there. It's what matters to them. That's what they value. And is there an in, because I'm generally doing work on people's behavior with individuals, is there an in that appeals to their values? And I've never not found an in.
And just for clarification, when you're talking about one-on-one work, you know, who is that with? Is that with colleagues, with senior leaders, with executives? And also when you are working with teams and organizations, and you talk about this scale, and often there are, you know, there is quite a journey to get further up that scale. You know, what are the actionable, the tangible steps that you help them embed to, you know, get further up the scale?
Oh, okay. So the individual stuff is usually with people who have strayed from an acceptable behavioral path. So we'll push them aside a wee bit. Incidentally, to a man and woman, really good people, totally invested in work, totally, I absolutely every single one of them, the thing they value is the best outcomes for patients. Yeah. They just don't understand the impact that they, firstly, don't understand how they're perceived by other people. And then they don't know the impact that that has on performance. But to go back to your question,
you do a lot of having difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And that become easier over time?
That's a practice issue, definitely. Like speaking on a stage, difficult conversations. If you go into a difficult conversation believing the other person deliberately behaved in an asshole-ish way, that is a difficult conversation because you're actually taking judgment into it. If you go into one of these difficult conversations around behavior, in the clear belief that people are frequently misunderstood and that everyone's trying to do the best thing, then you go into that conversation in a completely different way. You go into the conversation in a way that hopefully can hold some compassion for the person that you're talking with, and one where you can pass information to them rather than judgment. So, you know, Cheryl, you know, thanks for making the time to talk to me. After you spoke with Paul the other day, he was really upset. And I know you'd want to know. And that's not, you were a bitch. You know, that's not in there. That's not, you did something terrible.
I had no idea. I didn't realize.
Yeah. And do you know what? Nobody can tell you what percentage of the time people don't realize. Yeah. But in my experience, I've done loads of these. 95% plus.
You have a really good conversation around this with Adrian on the podcast, actually. And we're going to go on to talk about appreciative inquiry because I'm kind of conscious of time. This is so much.
No, I've still not told you how I got to do the TED Talk. Basically, I went to give a talk one day and I'd screwed my slide deck up. And they disappeared. And it was only a 20-minute talk. And I'd done enough of them by this point that I went, okay. And people said, oh, my God, do you want to stop? And I said, okay, no, it's all right. I think I can do this. Brilliant. Slide deck's gone. But I know it's rehearsal. You know, I knew my markers at this point. So I just did my talk. And there was a guy there, Simon. And Simon tweets under Orthopod Reg. And Simon for years.
I'd love to get him on the podcast. He doesn't know. I think he's coming to Australia, hopefully next year.
Well, Simon was there.
Simon. And,
yeah, Simon and I were chatting about it. And he said, oh, I might. He'd already done TED Talk at that point, and he put me on to, or put the guys on to me at TEDx NHS. And then from there, because there's sort of levels of TED Talks. There's ones you can't see online and there's ones you can see online. And from there, I gave another talk, TEDx Exeter, which is the easier one to find. And I mean, the TED process itself is really prescriptive. There is a reason why these TED Talks look kind of similar and feel kind of similar. And that's because they will coach you within an inch of your life. Now, I went to the first meeting for my first TED Talk, and I already had my talk. I didn't realize that they helped you to write the whole thing, for a lot of people at any rate. But got there and they says, anybody wants to show us where we've got to? And there was complete silence. And I said, well, I'll do mine. And it helped that I was 25 years older than everybody else in the room. So I just got up and did my talk. And they were like, okay, yeah, there's a few things we can brush up on, but that's great. And I thought that's nice. But then I discovered the people that I was with who gave fantastic talks, by the way. So if you ever get invited, you get supported through this whole process. They were just beginning to think about what they were thinking about. They didn't have product.
Yeah, very interesting. One of my previous guests, Dr. Mark Shapiro, has also done a TED Talk. Actually, very similar themes of compliments as a lever. It's also very powerful. But, you know, what you've just described as your experience, it really reflected his too. Clearly, that's not, you know, the norm, but also had clearly done a lot of, you know, work and thought up to this point that maybe unconsciously.
Yeah. I think the emotional stuff tends to be easy to get on. If we think about how we feel about things, and then we can show some data with it, people get on board with it. The TED experience, I have to tell you, I did not enjoy on either occasion. And that's because it's prescriptive and your product, and they really, really, really want this to be as good as it can be, but you feel a bit battered and bruised going through the process. They try and shape you into their thing. But it's a wonderful platform.
What about impact? Because I think the thing that many of us struggle with is how we actually get information, even in healthcare, to the right people in the right places. And I know that videos and stories work.
Yeah, and videos and stories and the TED brand pushes you out there. So you can see my TED Talk through a couple of routes. And it's not big by TED Talk standards, but it has been seen about 150,000 times. I suspect there at least 12,000 of those are my mum. But it's been seen many, many times. And, you know, people recurrently get in contact with me about it. So it's an amazing vehicle to get an idea across. And, you know, I'm exceptionally grateful to have had the opportunity to do it. That being said, they're not a ton of fun to go through. Yeah. Certainly not for somebody who's a wee bit anxious about going on stage.
And look, that's led you on, and you know, at one point you've already mentioned, Adrian, and the collaboration and the podcast and, you know, the combination of these two fantastic platforms with actually a shared purpose. Tell me about the story there. I think the podcast is phenomenal, actually.
Okay, so, and thank you for the comment about the podcast. I mean, you reminded me I'm meant to be re-listening to one of our other interviews and writing notes on it this weekend, so maybe I shall get around to that. So Adrian and I, as I said, known each other for years, and there's a group of people learning from excellence. Adrian's thing is learning from excellence. Rather than just looking at stuff that goes wrong, he likes to look at what's gone right and had a look to see if that can have impact. And of course, it's a powerful thing to do, but we haven't been doing it. So, you know, historically in medicine, we practice something called safety one, which is where we look for problems, we look for errors, and then we try and fix the error. And then we think, well, that problem won't happen again, particularly if we can put a systems approach to this to try and stop it, that thing happening again. Adrian said, what would happen if we looked at the stuff that had gone really well? And they started their Learning from Excellence program up. And that's the reason why I got introduced to Adrian, because at the time, myself and a guy called Scott Carrington were running an anonymous system. I haven't told anybody this before, called UROC. And our UROC anonymous system was something that we would, when we saw people doing good stuff, we would send them a postcard in the post, and it was anonymous. They never knew it was from us. And, you know, it's a long time ago now, so I'm not worried about people knowing it's us. And we would send them this to hopefully let them know that they were seen doing something really good. And Adrian's work's fascinating. Coming at it the way I do, and I'm interested in the data that sits around it. If you just want to look at trying to improve performance, Adrian Allison Jones did a study called the Praise Project. And buried within their work is what happened. The whole purpose of this is what happens if you tell people about stuff that they've done really well. And what they looked at was prescriptions in pediatric intensive care, which were handwritten at that time. And they said they already had a system for if you wrote a crap-looking prescription, but there's quite a lot of leeway in what makes for an okay prescription. And then there are bloody brilliant prescriptions that are just perfect. And what they started to do was they praised people. They sent them an email if they had written a perfect prescription. And when they started this project, the rate of perfect prescriptions was about 50% in ITU. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of systems people who go, oh my God, that's terrible, that's terrible, that's terrible. But that's just the truth of medicine. You know, you can pretty much work things out with a good enough, if not perfect, prescription. And then they start praising people. And what happens over 4 months, their rate of perfect prescriptions, and I'll get the stats a wee bit wrong here, went from 50% to 75% just by telling people they'd done well. And that really appeals to this idea of me about, I think of people as often like Labradors. You know, if you want a Labrador to keep doing something, give them praise when they've done something good, any dog, but I like Labradors because they're hungry, and you give them some food and they love that. And they go, there you go, I've been rewarded. I'm going to do that thing again. And that's what Adrian's work started to do. And then Adrian and I spent more and more time together. Now, I think really quickly, if you look at incidents, if you look at things that go wrong in healthcare, I think most of them probably, and go right, I think most of them sit on a bell curve, a normal distribution. And at the left-hand side of our normal distribution of stuff, and we could make it about a single thing, we make it about an appendicectomy. At the left-hand side of our curve of appendicectomies, there are the appendicectomies that go horribly wrong. And at the right-hand side, there's those that go amazingly well. And what we do in healthcare is that we look at the stuff that goes wrong, and that's the left-hand end of the graph, and we get an incident form, we have an investigation, we have an RCA, and we have a bit of blame, and people get a shoeing, and we feel a bit better about ourselves because we think that, you know, we've taken the bad apple out. And Adrian's work is all about what goes right and what can we replicate of the stuff that's gone right, rather than saying don't do wrong. So who's doing this brilliantly? What are they doing? And that's where the appreciative inquiry end of this comes into it. But I thought about this a lot, and Adrian's really interested in the learning from excellence end of stuff, and it's so powerful. And obviously, I am interested in that. But an awful lot of what I'm interested in actually exists at the other end of the spectrum. It's when things go wrong. And rather than looking at just the process of what's gone wrong, I am very interested in the interactions between the team when things go wrong, the people. Yeah. And what the research that I've read, and actually a little bit of the stuff that we've done as well, what it says is that people don't know the impact they're having on each other. If you start to have a conversation with folks, letting them know that this is important, then behavior changes. And Anna Baverstock in Somerset does absolutely brilliant work on this with the two Carolines. That's a terrible way of thinking about people, but it's because it's Anna that I speak to mostly, and the two Carolines that she works with, and the work they've done in maternity is incredible about behavior. Just by letting people know that behavior matters and showing them information that resonates with them, people choose to change their own behaviours. And that for me sits down in that sort of safety one end, that left-hand end of the graph. If we can start letting people know that behaviour matters in these complicated and complex situations, then we know that a whole bunch of people will choose to change. Once it's important, they will choose to change. We also know that there's a whole bunch of people down at that end of the graph who have no idea the impact their behaviour is having on other people and have no idea how they're perceived. Yeah. And for them, we have developed a whole bunch of other stuff. And, you know, and we're all misunderstood. And the things that I get into, and I realise we are running out of time, we get into understanding misunderstandings.
And so what does that look like on the ground, actually working with people, your team, colleagues?
It works. So there's the didactic part of it. So there's civility saves lives. The bottom line to civility saves lives is behaviour matters. It has a demonstrable impact on performance. We used to then talk about how might we then hold a conversation with somebody about the about how they were perceived in a conversation. And that's a bit we talked about just a wee bit earlier about how you might go and say, let somebody know about this. And there's a ton of work in that. And it's all really loosely based on Jerry Hickson's work in Vanderbilt. But then in the middle, there was a kind of missing link. And the missing link was understanding misunderstandings. And this recognition that, and this is work that we've done in part, the recognition that people are trying to do the right thing. You can get four different people, give them exactly the same situation. They might well do four wildly different things, but they are all trying to do the right thing. And understanding what makes it right from their perspective is the thing that helps us to understand the problem a wee bit better. So there's a branch of ethics called the sort of normative ethics of doing the right thing. And instead of the ethics that people get taught at university, or which are principalist ethics of beneficence, non-maleficence, justice, and autonomy, instead of that, this is ethics that says you did what you thought was right, what made it right for you. And people split into three groups, broadly speaking. They're consequentialists. So they did what they thought was right because the only thing that matters to them is the end result. How you get there is not important. And that's it's a truly dangerous place for people who have a lot of power to be thinking from. But it's also a place that we force a lot of chief execs into when we say to them things like, you know, if you don't hit this target, you're going to lose your job. It's no surprise they turn around to the guys who work with and say, I don't care how we hit it, just hit the bloody target. And then you get bedlam in your organization. The other next group of people who practice something called deontology. Deontologists will have done the right thing if they followed the rules, even if the rules don't work in this situation. And with the broadest of brushes, at a very junior level, we expect people to follow the rules. And different professions are expected to follow the rules for longer in their careers than each other. And you can think about that for yourselves, about which professions that might be alluding to there. And then the third group are people who practice what's called phronesis, P-H-R-O-N-E-S-I-S, which is effectively practical wisdom. It's what's the practically wise decision to make in this given situation. But of course, you have to have the permission to behave in any way you see fit in that situation. And very few people are given that. Doctors at a senior level are, but they don't recognize that this is not everybody else's right to behave like that.
Yeah, this very much feeds into the work of, you know, Amy Edmondson, my colleague, Dr. Purdy, on how you build psychological safety. You know, you might have, and I know many organisations might have a speaking up for safety programme, campaign, but, you know, the kind of realities is that is fruitless if you don't actually have a culture and environment that supports speaking up. And, you know, the challenges are how you actually create and foster that. And I agree. I probably don't know my own privilege in terms of having a voice, and also where my own, you know, blind spots and biases are.
Yeah. So this missing link bit that sat between the behaviour matters and how you're going to have the conversation was, hey, everyone's trying to do the right thing. And I can talk about that till the cows come home. But alongside that, understanding misunderstandings, understanding that we think that we communicate brilliantly with other people and we think we understand them even better than they understand us. And actually, we don't. We do communicate really well, but we miss out on lots of stuff. When we are speaking to each other, when it's got nuance, when it's got emotion, maybe a wee bit of sarcasm, we still misinterpret 22% of that. But when we send an email to each other, and we think emails, well, you know, it's written down, you should be able to understand it. Emails are a bloody disaster. When we send emails to each other, we misunderstand about 46% of it.
They're worse than my brisk Scottishness.
It sort of depends. Your brisk Scottishness might be problematic. I have this as well. So it might be problematic because people might be scared already in the conversation. and we diminish people when we make them scared. So it's difficult to be sure, but probably emails are worse. And, you know, if you're receiving an email and you're only understanding 54, 56% of it, and then you find that you're riled by it and angry, and then you reply, and we've all heard it, somebody on the other side of the office, you hear them tapping their keyboard in a truly aggressive way. And you're going, oh my goodness, what's going on there? Then what happens is that people, the misinterpretation of each other can sometimes lead to somebody receiving an email from you which goes, holy hell, what's wrong with them? And then you get one back from them where they're going to push him back a wee bit. And then next thing you know, you've got this mushroom cloud of anger being chucked about, sometimes with a few CCs being added in as people go, can you believe what this person is saying to me? And email's a catastrophe for trying to get across nuance. It's okay for saying the number seven, but we think that using emails leaves a very clear trail of what people are saying, and actually they don't. They're massively open to interpretation. There's all sorts of reasons why, but we don't have time to deconstruct it at the moment. But I think that it helps people to know that. It helps people to know that folk are trying to do the right thing and that we misinterpret each other left, right, and centre. If we can bring those two things together, maybe we can get ourselves into a situation where we can give ourselves permission to be kinder to ourselves when we're misinterpreted by other people, but to be kinder to them as well, because we might well be misinterpreting what they are sending to us. And that's a very powerful place to get to, where you don't rush to judgment, where you rush to, if you rush anywhere, you're rushing to curiosity, not to judgment.
Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you. It's powerful. And of course, now I'm thinking about Ted Lasso, and thank you, because I wanted an excuse to use Ted Lasso as a segue into the last question. But, you know, that last part, be curious, not judgmental. And just thank you again for reiterating what you have, you know, returned to throughout this conversation, that, you know, with few exceptions, that the vast majority of the time we're all trying to do our best for our patients, for each other. You know, we don't want to be unkind to our colleagues. We don't want to make mistakes. We're working in, you know, very challenging, complex, ever-changing systems. And I think increasingly in silos and are disconnected. So, you know, while we're all working and operating through our lens, we actually often don't even have a frame for the other person's perspective or lens, which can make it more challenging to even see our blind spots. And that last piece that you brought in, which again is something I've spoken about on the podcast, something I think about a lot, is the self-compassion, you know, which is often missing. It's Shari Johnson's stoicism, perfectionism, competition, and you know, not being able to offer that same compassion or kindness to ourselves and being our own worst critics. You know, initiatives like Schwartz Rounds are a way to kind of start breaking down silos, sharing perspective and lens, thinking about how it feels to care, and bringing that self-compassion piece back in. You know, and quite encouraged to see how, you know, the kind of research and experience and around that develops. I think to, because I know we are running out of time, I could speak to you all day, bringing back into Ted Lasso, the I appreciate you piece, because I wanted to talk a bit about appreciative inquiry. And I have to say, when I think of I appreciate you, I think of I respect you, I admire you, great work, not in the way, I come from a family of accountants, and they think of that in the way it's probably intended, in that I actually want to build and capitalize on that and appreciate you. Which, you know, I think I hadn't heard of appreciative inquiry until I was doing a course last year, and then listening to your podcast and those final conversations with a bit of a focus on this. So in the spirit of that, you know, what does your work look like at its best? And what is your vision for where it might go?
Okay. So how is appreciative inquiry and, you know, inquiry? I try and base all the QI work that I do on that. So we look at where we are, we look at what great would look like, and we say, how do we get there? We don't look at where we are, and we don't say, so what's crap about where we are?
Which is very easy to do. I've been guilty of that. And, you know, it is very demotivating. You do have negative momentum when you kind of get into that mindset.
Yeah, it can be demotivating, but I think it's a process that people need to go through. They need to be heard about the difficulty of the system that they're currently working in. And, you know, otherwise there's a real risk that, you know, we end up being overly optimistic and sort of negativity deniers, because there's a lot of difficult stuff in what people are doing on a day-to-day basis, and there's a lot of systems that really don't work very well. So letting people get that off their chest appears to be important. And even the sort of best practitioners of the appreciative inquiry stuff, people like Suzanne Quinney was talking about this, about how you just need to let this stuff come out, but then move it along and say, okay, hear all that. What would brilliant look like? And then once we've established the place we're trying to get to, then say, effectively, how are we going to get there? What are the barriers? What are the obstacles? What are the things that are going to be really good along the way? Recognizing the micro wins, and not being somebody who only accepts when we get to the perfect place, because, you know, perfection is the enemy of good and all that. Actually recognizing that we do good stuff on the journey. The journey itself has lots of merit, and reflecting on that and getting into that with people, so that as we go along, we keep their motivation going, because we're saying, hey, we've achieved this, we've achieved this, we've achieved this. And not just people perpetually looking at the summit and saying, we're not there yet. Because actually, people, that can be demotivating to feel like you're not getting there yet. So recognizing the micro wins as we go along, and thinking about where we were, where we are now, and understanding some of the discomfort of the journey. And trying to counter that with a recognition of achievement. So that's in a nutshell how I try to use appreciative inquiry. And I have to say, appreciative inquiry, just the introduction to it, has completely changed my relationship with change management. And also, it's so much less damaging to use appreciative inquiry to try and achieve something as a leader than it is to go in and point out what's wrong and be perpetually mired in the badness of the place you're working in. And the problem with working in governance, to go right back to the beginning, is that people weren't sending me emails about what was going well. I was getting emails about what had gone wrong yesterday, the day before, today. And I felt like I was perpetually fighting fires. So meeting Adrian Plunkett, getting to talk to him about recognizing the positive stuff, the impact of that made a huge difference to my world. I would hugely commend appreciative inquiry to folk who are interested in it. There's lots of different models. And unfortunately, some of the language in it can be it's a little bit antagonistic to people in healthcare, you know, the dream phase. We're now going to go into the dream phase. Well, how about we just talk about what brilliant would look like?
Positivity kind of slant.
Yeah. Yeah. And your other comment was, where is civility saves lives going? I have no idea. When asked to describe this, at no point has this had any purpose other than to push an idea out there that may or may not resonate with people. And I often think about it as drifting around on a life raft somewhere at sea, and it goes in different directions. And
you must know you're making a difference, though, and having impact.
Well, yeah, I mean, I hope so. I mean, I certainly get enough platforms that hopefully I am. Hopefully the other, I mean, not just me, there's lots of people who talk about this stuff. It's on a personal level. Yeah, hopefully I am. But there's no grand plan, nothing at all. It's, you know, the way we run it, anybody, anywhere can use any of the stuff we produce. There's no licensing. It's Creative Commons. They can use the logo. They can do what they like in any way they like. And we trust that people will be doing it with good reason, good purpose, and good meaning. And if they don't, they don't. That's just what would happen. So I'm just enjoying the ride.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for making time to share the journey and the story to date. You know, I love that this conversation has come full circle, starting in a place, you know, we've seen that evolution from a place that was very dark and negative for you professionally, personally, but undoubtedly filled with lots of opportunity for growth and learning, to this lighter, brighter and much more optimistic place. And the work that you're doing now that, you know, is far reaching. So thank you for inspiring us. I'm excited to see what you will do next and where it will go. I'm very conscious that I've gone way over time. I normally have a series of questions at the end, but if I could just ask you one of those, we have a big focus on our well-being and ability to keep showing up on this podcast. And, you know, I think at the beginning of this conversation, you gave a very powerful example of a period of severe burnout, of moral distress in your own career. And we know that a big driver of that is that disconnect between, you know, our ideals for patient care and, you know, the realities of the challenging systems that we're working in conspiring against that. And so, you know, I'd like to know, with, you know, that time and perspective, what does well-being mean to you now? And what does it look like, you know, professionally, personally?
Okay. So I would say the biggest message about well-being that has come to me over the last few years has been that well-being is not an individual pursuit. It is collective. It's not about Chris and Sleepio and Chris and Headspace and Chris and trying to be the most resilient individual. It's actually about all of us. And I think of us as a sea. We are interconnected. When things are going bad for some people in your workplace or in your life, they tend to be going bad for other people as well. And we support each other, and we roll and we roil, and our seas heave and our seas go calm together. And we do that by looking after each other. We do that by caring about the people around us, by recognizing the people who are in trouble and walking towards them, not away from them, when we have the capacity to do that. And we understand our world and meaning and this dissonance that you were talking about there. We understand that far better when we spend time together making sense of what has happened. And that making sense of complicated and complex things is not an individual pursuit. It is a collective pursuit for most of us, so that we can get our head around that. And I don't think we've done that particularly well in this country, and particularly in England coming out of COVID. I think we've had a lot of staff who went to intensive care units and helped to be part of proning teams and helped to look after these incredibly sick patients. And these guys often came from things like outpatients. And then they were no longer needed in the proning team. And we got to the end of that particular wave and they got sent back to their other department. But they don't see death. If you work in outpatients, you don't see death. Death is represented in outpatients by an empty chair. But they were on intensive care and they were with these teams and 50% of patients were dying. And I'm not sure that we've given the time to them to help them to make sense of that experience of delivering healthcare, which is massively different to their day-to-day experience. And I do hear stories of large numbers of nursing staff who were put into the intensive care units who are in really difficult spaces and who are on a lot of medication after that period of time. And I think we don't recognize the importance of collectively making sense, but also the importance of collectively supporting each other. And that when we do that, we're better for ourselves, but we're better for other people as well.
Yeah, thank you. A really powerful note to end on. And I think you've so eloquently spoken to the challenges that we're facing. Our people are our most precious asset in healthcare. If we don't look after, support and sustain them, then our patients suffer. Thank you again. I will link the website, the platform, the podcast in the show notes and the TED Talk. And I really hope we get to meet in person sometime soon.
Brooke, Cheryl, it was lovely to see you. Have a great day.
Cheers. You have been listening to Dr. Chris Turner on the Mindful Medic podcast. As I've said, I'll put the key links and references in the show notes so that you can find out more about Chris and his work at Civility Saves Lives. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I have quite a few take-homes. But I think, going back to the shop floor tomorrow, just that reminder that, the vast majority of us turn up at work to do the best we can for each other, for our patients. We don't set out planning to be rude to each other. And, the reminder to start the difficult conversation, to ask, to listen, and in the spirit of trying to find that shared perspective. I was also particularly struck by Chris's own story and journey as a clinician to date. I think he gave a very powerful example of the impact, a trusted mentor, a critical friend can have on us in our toughest and more challenging times. And also, thinking of Steve Magnus's skills come from struggle, the opportunity for post-traumatic growth after a really challenging period. The skills and expertise that, subsequently are gained. And it's really lovely to see, this place of curiosity, of optimism, of appreciative inquiry that he now finds himself in and working in. And you can really see the journey to become the wise leader.
But I think that it helps people to know that. It helps people to know that folk are trying to do the right thing and that we misinterpret each other left, right, and centre. If we can bring those two things together, maybe we can get ourselves into a situation where we can give ourselves permission to be kinder to ourselves when we're misinterpreted by other people, but to be kinder to them as well, because we might well be misinterpreting what they are sending to us. And that's a very powerful place to get to, where you don't rush to judgment, if you rush anywhere, you're rushing to curiosity, not to judgment.
Thanks again to our sponsors, the MBA of New South Wales. They do wonderful work for our colleagues who are at this very minute experiencing a hard time. One way you can show you care about doctors' welfare is to go to their website, www.mbansw.org.au, and donate today. Knowing that their colleagues care is a big part of these doctors' recovery, so please be part of the solution. All donations are tax deductible. If you can, please also consider a monthly donation, as even small amounts collectively will allow them to plan their growth to support their increased demand.